Psalm 104 is either verse 1 or 2, where it describes the stretching out of the heavens as being like a tent curtain, like a surface. And so I understand that we're like our three-dimensional space here is like a surface. Is that like on four-dimensional space or what? I don't know.
Okay, good question. If you want to read about this in some detail, I've wrote an article. It's on our website at reasons.org. I wrote it in 2023. What does the Bible say about the Big Bang? Is it really true that the Bible predicted features of the Big Bang thousands of years before astronomers discovered it? And I make the point that without doubt, it has at least predicted three of the fundamental features of what we now know to be Big Bang cosmology. Namely, that the universe has a beginning, and that beginning includes not just the beginning of matter and energy, but the beginning of space and time itself, and how the laws of physics do not change. They're constant from the moment of creation, so they're immutable. Jeremiah 33:25, God says, I'm a God that does not change. As proof, look to the laws that govern the heavens and the earth, as they have not changed, I have not changed. And how we see in the Romans 8 and in Ecclesiastes 1 that one of those laws is this pervasive law of decay, how everything is subject to a law of decay. And now those are the three most significant features of Big Bang cosmology. Now, a fourth one that's been debated that you just brought up is that there's these passages that talk about God stretching out the heavens. Is that really a biblical statement that God not only created the universe, created space and time, but created the universe with a property that it continues to stretch out over time? Well, there are 11 texts in the Bible that talk about the stretching out of the heavens. The Hebrew verb there is the verb natah, which means the expansion of what is being described. And you'll also see that it shows up in all three Hebrew verb forms, which implies that when God created the universe, he created it with the property of ongoing expansion, and also that it continues to expand as the universe gets older and older. And if you've got a universe subject to a pervasive law of decay, where the universe is expanding over time, that's a universe that must get colder and colder in a highly predictable way. Now, there are theologians who are not scientists, who basically look at this and say, well, we agree with the first three. We're not sure if we can push it to the fourth step and say it talks about the expansion, because there's different ways we can understand the expansion. So what I did in the article I wrote is I featured a debate between two theologians. John Ray, who insists that these 11 texts really do speak about a literal expansion of the universe, and Vern Poitras, who says, well, maybe, but I'm not absolutely certain that that's the case. But nobody disputes the first three, and very many think that, hey, there's at least four. And what you just pointed out is that there are two texts, Psalm 104, especially, that actually use a figure of speech, how God stretches out the heavens like one would stretch out a tent in order to live in the tent. And I don't know how many have ever gone backpacking, but when you go backpacking, you have a little tent rolled up in a little bag, and when it's finished with your day of hiking, you take that bag out of your backpack, and you basically unfurl the tent, stretch it out so that you can live inside of it. And so Psalm 104 uses that figure of speech for the stretching out of the heavens, basically conveying that the universe is like a tent surface. And namely that the reality of the tent is the surface of the tent, not what's inside the tent or outside the tent. And I've actually argued in The Creator and the Cosmos, that's an excellent analogy for the universe in which we live. Because the universe in which we live, everything is on the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional universe. All the stars and galaxies, all the matter and energy is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional universe. And if you want an analogy, think of planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body but we humans live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. With the universe, just pop everything up by one dimension. Three-dimensional surface on a four-dimensional universe. And people always ask me, hey, this sounds great. Can you give me a visual picture for it? No, I can't. You can only visualize phenomena and dimensions you personally experience. And we personally experience three spatial dimensions, not four. In fact, years ago, when I was 19, I took a course on extra-dimensional mathematics. And we were given problem assignments in four, five, six, seven, even a million dimensions of space. And we could solve all the mathematics for it and prove that certain things were true or not true, but none of us could visualize what was going on. In fact, when I did my radio astronomy research at Caltech, we discovered it was much easier mathematically to take these maps of radio galaxies we were doing, and we basically put everything into five dimensions of space, did the mathematics, and once we got the answer we wanted, we translated it down to three dimensions. And I noticed that the engineers that were working there at the Owens Valley Radio Astronomy, they would joke and say, don't bother that astronomer, he's in the UV plane, he's not with us, because he's in these extra dimensions. So, but it's all mathematical. But yeah, I think that's a powerful verse to say that, hey, the figure of speech used twice actually sustains the interpretation that these 11 texts are meant to be literal, because there's only two figures of speech, not 11, just two. And therefore, and the fact that he uses all three Hebrew verbs, I think is a strong case. So I basically side with John Ray. But in the article, I basically let you see the written debate between the two theologians so you can draw your own conclusion. Next question.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross. What do you think is God's plan in creating such a big universe? Could it be to create life elsewhere, or for humans to expand to other planets and galaxies?
Okay, good question. And that's actually what I'm going to be speaking about next Sunday at the 9 o'clock service. Just, I'm going to begin by talking about, well, here's a way to help them get an idea how big God is. Let's first look at how big the universe is. And it's kind of mind-blowing when you actually think of just how enormous the universe is. But the most blind, mind-blowing thing of all, change the total size of the universe by as little as one part in a quadrillion, 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 no life is possible anytime, anywhere in the universe. So make the universe the tiniest bit smaller, none of us would be here. Make it the tiniest bit bigger, none of us would be here. So yeah, if you want to know why, come next Sunday and I'll explain it to you and actually show you some of the latest images, just declaring how incredibly big our universe is. 2 trillion galaxies. Each galaxy has over 100 billion stars, where all those galaxies make up only 0.25% of all the stuff of the universe. But change it by that little amount, we wouldn't be here. Which says something about the degree of love and care that God has for us human beings. He loved us to such a great degree, he didn't think it was too costly to make a universe of 2 trillion galaxies, where that makes up only 0.25% of all the stuff of the universe, that's so that we could be here. But I'm also going to pick up on just what I said earlier. When we look at the universe, we shouldn't think of it as length, width, height, and time. It's bigger than that. So I'll be sharing with you how we now know that there are 10 dimensions that make up this universe, not just four, which means the God we worship is bigger than 10 dimensions. He created those 10 dimensions. And I'm going to close the talk off by showing you, once we recognize how big and powerful God is, how do we explain how in just 6 to 9 hours on the cross, Jesus was able to suffer the equivalent penalty of eternal torment for every human being who's ever lived since Adam and Eve? So I have a little visual picture to kind of help you see that. And what does that really mean? If we understand just the degree of what God has done on our behalf, as it says in Hebrews 2:3, how can anyone turn down such a magnificent offer of salvation? So if you've got some unbelieving friends, I encourage you to bring them with you next Sunday to hear that. And hey, they can ask questions, and they want to hear about the lessons you can get from the animals. They can stay for both services. Okay, next.
The Bible warns about being careful about people that come along just to tickle your ear, to kind of give you new thoughts and fancy things and take you away from the solid part of the gospel. It's quite interesting. I've been on a number of forums debating and talking about scientific discoveries that people seem to be tickling the public's ear with, and that's particularly of claiming that we have found habitable planets with water. And of course, it's been very easy to refute this because the planets that people are citing as water worlds or places where they found carbon with life forms on it, these planets are much bigger than Earth, which means there's no life there. They're very close to their star, which means there's no life there. They're tidally locked. And these stars are very unstable, you know, just fluctuating, you know, multiple percents. And so refuting these has been quite interesting. And of course, then the question comes back is, if that's true, why are these scientists making these claims when obviously, you know, the data that I'm showing from NASA shows that these places can't have life? It seems to be like the tickling of the ear in science is happening just like the Bible warns about in Scripture.
Well, the mantra of NASA has been follow the water, because we all know life of any conceivable form needs liquid water. There really is no other solvent that's going to make it possible to have living systems. And so you're not going to have life if you don't have water. And what they mean is liquid water. And so the goal of NASA is to find these planets with liquid water. They're going to be the best candidates to have planets in which life is possible, because that's a requirement for life. And on that basis, you'll see in the NASA website, you know, there's 40 billion habitable planets in our galaxy alone. Now, what they're not revealing is that life requires more than just liquid water. In fact, in terms of the planetary characteristics, we now know of 13 other planetary requirements in order for life to possibly exist. And the most generous of those planetary habitable zones is the liquid water habitable zone. So it's the broadest, and therefore allows for the greatest population of planets to fall within the possibility of having liquid water existing on them at some place and at some time in the history of the planet. All the other known planetary zones have much more restrictive requirements. And so in an article on reasons.org and in my book, Improbable Planet and Design to the Core, you'll find 14 known planetary habitable zones. I say known because we seem to be discovering a new one about every year. So next year we might have 15, then 16, but so far we know of 14. And of the almost 6,000 planets that have been discovered outside of our solar system, we have yet to find even one planet that exists in even three of those 14 known habitable zones. And the one planet that fits in the three is the one we're living on right now. So the one that fits in all three is one that also fits in all 14. And so the best we've found outside of planet Earth is one that resides in two of those known planetary habitable zones. And what I did in Design to the Core is give you a list of six planets that come the closest, six planets that we've discovered that come the closest to matching planet Earth in its capacity to support life. You know what that second best planet is? It's Venus. We've yet to find a planet outside of the solar system that comes anywhere close to being as Earth-like as a planet Venus. Now, the one that Dave mentioned, we are indeed finding planets outside the solar system that likely have liquid water on them. The problem is they got way too much liquid water. So we have found about four planets that have liquid water, but they have oceans that are thousands of kilometers deep. When you get oceans that are thousands of kilometers deep, the pressure of the water on top is so great when you get down the bottom, it causes that water to freeze. So you've all been told that when water freezes, it floats. That's true if you got water at a relatively low density. So Earth's oceans are sufficiently shallow that the pressure, even in the Marianas Trench, is not great enough to put a second form of ice there. So there is no ice at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, in spite of the fact that 38,000 feet of water lie above it. The pressure simply isn't great enough. But if you've got more than, say, 700 kilometers depth of water, you will get ice floating on the top. You also get ice at the bottom. And the problem is this. The ice at the bottom is permanent. It's not going to melt. If you've got that much liquid water on that planet, you will get frozen ice at the bottom. And that becomes a barrier separating the liquid water from the rock. And if there's no contact between the liquid water and the rock, there's no possibility for life. Because although water is essential for life, if all you got is water, you're not going to have life. Life needs things like carbon, silicon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, and you need contact with a rock to be able to get those elements. So that's the problem. And one of the wonders of planet Earth, Earth is big and rocky and far away from its host star, and yet it has only a tiny amount of water. Our planet is about 0.02 to 0.03% water. These planets that we're finding are 5 to 15% water. And so one of the things that makes life possible on planet Earth is that we're extremely water poor. And it actually takes a remarkable event, two planets colliding with one another at the distance they are from the sun, in order to transform our planet from being a very a water world to a planet with very little water. So Earth in its primordial state indeed had oceans thousands of kilometers deep. But it was the collision it suffered with the rocky planet Theia that basically stripped away its water and its very thick atmosphere and allowed Earth to be as distant as it is from the sun and yet have a very thin layer of water and a very thin layer of atmosphere, which are crucial for life. And this is easy to understand. Okay, the more massive the planet, the denser the planet, and the farther away it is from its host star, the lighter material its gravity will be able to accumulate. And so you see this with Mercury, and with Venus, and with Mars, is that this principle applies. Mercury has a very thin atmosphere, just a thin argon atmosphere, and that's because it's so close to the sun with such a small mass that the only gas it can possibly gather to itself is the argon, argon being a very heavy gas, and also gets a tiny amount of xenon and krypton along with it. Whereas now we've even got Venus. Venus is significantly bigger than Mercury, and it's farther away from the sun. And therefore, the heat of the sun doesn't drive off the light material, and so Venus has a very thick atmosphere, 90 times thicker than the Earth. And because that atmosphere is so thick, and because it's predominantly carbon dioxide, it traps heat from the sun to such a degree there's no liquid water on Venus at all. Basically, it's 800 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface of Venus, and that drove off all the water. The principle also applies with Mars. Mars, being only 1/9 the mass of the Earth, doesn't have sufficient mass to gather unto itself, things like water or methane or ammonia. Its gravity is not sufficient to hang onto water, so it's got a thin atmosphere of carbon dioxide. Earth is the exception. Earth should have a huge quantity of water and a very thick atmosphere, 200 times thicker than it has today, based on its size and density and distance from the sun. It was the collision with Theia that prevented that from happening. And if you want life, you got to be far away from the star. By the way, we've yet to find a rocky planet orbiting another star that orbits farther away from that star than Venus orbits the sun. In fact, we found one that orbits as far away as Mercury. That's it. And so one of the unique features of the solar system, we've got big rocky planets that orbit far from the host star. And the appendix in Design to the Core explains the miracles that enabled our star, the sun, to have rocky planets that orbit far away instead of up close. And we know of no other system where that's the case.
Well, Hugh, we're back online, which means we're back in the real world, so.
So does that also mean that the recording's intact?
I don't know.
Okay.
I will find out. Robert Gibson asks, regarding day three in Genesis, did plants originate multiple times or just once? And how would the origins of plants affect how we discuss God's creation and the gospel with other people?
Right. Well, what you see in Genesis creation day three, and I'll be talking about this when we do our series, it says, let the land produce desheh. That's a Hebrew word for vegetation, or we would understand photosynthetic life forms. So it's a very broad term. It would actually encompass all the cyanobacteria on the face of the earth. But it's basically saying not only are to have photosynthetic life in the ocean, we're to have it on the land masses. And so let the land produce desheh, and then it gives three examples and basically uses three Hebrew words that typically are translated into the English as trees, fruit, and seeds. But as I'll be explaining, those three Hebrew words have very broad definitions. And so this is one of the problems. I remember debating an atheist on a university campus and saying, how can you possibly believe that Genesis is correct when it says there are apricot trees on creation day three? Well, it doesn't say apricot trees, but it does use the words trees, fruit, and seeds. But the word for tree would basically apply to any kind of life form that has some stiffness to it as a result of, for example, a cellulose. And they're microbial life forms that have that property. So we're not to understand it as sequoia trees here in California or apricot trees. And likewise, when it talks about fruit, this is the food supply that enables the plants, the seeds of the plants, to survive long enough that they can germinate and become, vegetative things. So let the land produce vegetation does play a role, because now that you have vegetation on the land masses as well as in the oceans, it's an extra supply of oxygen in the atmosphere and an extra source of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is crucial to compensate for the sun getting brighter and brighter. So vegetation does play a key role in actually maintaining the possibility for life on planet Earth. That's the amazing thing about our planet. We've had abundant life for 3.8 billion years, in spite of the fact that the sun is 23% brighter today than it was at the origin of life. And that's because God is putting life on planet Earth in a sequence whereby carbon dioxide is being removed and oxygen is replacing the carbon dioxide that's being removed. And so carbon dioxide being a greenhouse gas, it starts off at 100,000 parts per million, and today it's down to 400 parts per million. That's all because we got God ensuring we got the right life on the planet at the right time, so that as the sun's getting brighter and brighter, there's less and less carbon dioxide to trap heat from the sun. And also, if you're going to have animals running around, you need plants. That's a fundamental food source. So they need some kind of vegetation.
Robert Gibson has another question. He says, without Asa or Bara, would the origin of plants on day three be a stronger or weaker argument for God as compared to other arguments for God?
Yeah, good point. What you see in Genesis 1, when it talks about God's creative activity, it uses the verbs bara to create, the verb asa to manufacture, and the verb haya, let there be. Let there be does not rule out the possibility of God supernaturally placing those life forms on planet Earth, but it does allow for the possibility that some of that differentiation could be by natural process. And so it basically leaves it up to the scientists to dig into the fossil record of the Earth and saying, we think this part of the differentiation happened by natural process, but this part was supernatural intervention. Whereas the use of the verbs bara and asa, it's 100% supernatural intervention. There's no room for God just allowing things to happen through the laws of physics that he set up.
Thank you, Hugh. Let's see, Jared Neal says, has anyone suggested a more accurate, truth-filled metaphor for the expanding universe that would have been comprehensible to, say, a second millennium BC person or pastoral society?
Yeah, that's an excellent point that he's making, and it's an argument I heard John Ray make. He said, you know, I really believe these 11 passages literally are speaking about the continual ongoing expansion of the universe from a universe that God created initially with the property of ongoing expansion, because there's no better way to communicate that given the biblical Hebrew that was available to Job and to Moses. So yeah, given the limited vocabulary of biblical Hebrew, he argues, and frankly I agree with him, is that that really is the best way to communicate the principle we now understand to be at the core of the Big Bang. By the way, as I've interviewed theologians who are reluctant to read Big Bang cosmology, and this is especially true of John Walton, and by the way, I know John personally, and we've actually ministered together, is that John's very reluctant to read Big Bang cosmology into the Bible, and likewise a number of other theologians are, which is why they back away from these 11 passages, because they're concerned that astrophysics might advance to a point where we have to replace the Big Bang model with a new cosmological model. And as you know, an observational cosmologist, I've been trying to persuade them that's not going to happen. The case for Big Bang cosmology is at a point where, but the problem is these theologians realize, wait a minute, I'm old enough to remember when there was a debate between steady state and Big Bang. The Big Bang hasn't been around that long. It's true, the Big Bang hasn't been around that long, but the case for a Big Bang universe is such that there's no concern it's going to be overturned by advancing astronomical observations. Although if you read and lay articles on the web, you might think that that's not happening. But what people are not realizing is the debate you see in these web articles and the scientific literature is between different Big Bang creation models. And so a lot of these theologians and lay people as well have the idea that in astrophysics we have a single Big Bang creation model. Not true. We got about a dozen distinct Big Bang creation models. And the goal is to find which of those distinct Big Bang creation models correctly describes the origin and history of the universe. But guess what? All of the viable models are Big Bang models, 100%. The Big Bang does not have any competition.
I've heard, Hugh, that some pastors say that they want to discount all Christian apologetics for that reason. That the, you know, it looks like evidence today, but the next generation, it may not be evidence anymore, and they're afraid to look at the Bible in any way that supports the science.
Well, once again, that's exactly what John Walton states, is we cannot wed our Bible to the book of nature because science is always changing. And therefore, he's critiqued me saying it's a mistake to engage in scientific apologetics because your science could be overturned literally the next day. And so I have to explain to him, look, I've been educated as a scientist, and guess what? When I took a course in electromagnetic theory, it was basically the physics that was being taught in the 19th century. And by the way, it'll be the physics that'll be taught in the 25th century. That's not going away. Or to use a more, I think, lay-friendly example is that we don't have to worry about some scientist making a discovery and saying, well, we thought the law of gravity was real. We thought Galileo knew what he was saying, that massive bodies will fall towards the center of the Earth. I think he got it all wrong. That's not going to happen. Or as a number of scientists have said, science advances by modern-day scientists standing on the giants of science giants of the past. And so we're not ever going to overthrow Galileo, but we build on what Galileo has discovered. And so just like, and in fact, I use the analogy of theology. When you read the Bible, there are certain doctrines in the Bible that we realize theological research will never overturn. So for example, the doctrine of the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. That's not up for debate. That's so explicitly taught in the Bible that there's no basis for saying, well, maybe we got this wrong. No, parts of what the Bible reveals are clear and substantial and are not up for debate. The same thing's true of God's book of nature. There are things in the book of nature that are secure and solid. Like the laws of physics don't change. We know what those laws are, the law of gravity, the law of electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear force. Nothing's going to happen when we say, well, I guess we had it wrong about the electromagnetic theory. That will not happen. But there's things beyond that that are up for debate. Just like there are things in the Bible that are up for debate. I think people are going to be debating end times prophecy until the Lord returns. Because, you know, it's not one of the core doctrines of Christianity. What is core, Jesus will return. The second coming, that's when they have notice. Theologians have all these different models about how we interpret the return of Christ, but they all agree the Bible is very clear. He is coming back. There will be a second coming. Everything else is up for grabs. Just like it's up for grabs, which of the dozen plus Big Bang creation models really correctly describes the universe. So it's amazing how remarkably similar the book of nature is to the book of Scripture. Both of them have things that are very clear, very perspicuous, solid, not up for change, but both books also have a lot where we're seeing through a glass darkly. No matter how much we research it, we'll never have complete understanding, which is what makes theology fun. It's what makes science fun. I hope you're all having fun.
We're having a lot of fun, Hugh. Thank you. Would you please close us with a prayer?
Sure. Father in heaven, I do pray that we would have fun enjoying the study and the research and the reading of your two books, the book of nature and this book of Scripture. Lord, that we would have so much fun that people would see that joy and begin to ask us, why are you so happy about this? And that would give us an opportunity to share how these two books reveal you, your characteristics, and your plan for our lives, and just what an exciting future we have, not just in this creation, but in the creation to come. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.